If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
The following is a special CJSF presentation. It interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot.
Program is part 7 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part 7 focuses on caste. This program is dedicated to Dalit people everywhere, and all those oppressed by and fighting against a caste system.
My name is Yashika Dutt. I'm a Dalit journalist and author of Coming Out as Dalit. And I've been working in the anti-caste space for several years now, highlighting issues of lack of Dalit representation and the discrimination that we face because of our caste in the US and India both. In India, there is a very strict and still present caste system. And people who belong to the so-called untouchable castes, many of them felt like they needed a common identity, a common identifier to bring us all together, because the caste system is highly divided and there is a descending order of contempt, which means that the lower you go in the caste system, the more untouchable you are, the higher the discrimination, the higher the contempt against you. And I think around the 60s or the 70s, this idea became really widespread that let's call ourselves Dalit. And in Hindi and many other Indian languages, Dalit means somebody who has been crushed, somebody who has been oppressed. So this is a way for the community to take back the power in our own hands, to reclaim our oppression by labeling and identifying clearly what happens to us. This word has found recognition in the work and text of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, who is the most recognized Dalit civil rights leader, who is responsible for the affirmative action that Dalits have, and also who is the architect of the Indian Constitution. And he has used the word Dalit also in his texts. I do want to underscore, not going into too much nuance here, but there is also some contestation around this word, where many feel that this is not how we should identify ourselves. But for better or for worse, this is the name that has stuck for many of us, and it works for now. So we call ourselves as Dalit people. There is a rigid caste system, but as any system of discrimination that exists, it has gone through a series of evolutions and changes. And in India, those measures were specifically and most importantly introduced right after Indian independence in the 1940s. And 1950, where our constitution was adopted, gave us several affirmative action measures, declaring that Dalits are equal to every other person in the country, just declaring equality across the board, and having a very strong focus on social parity. But as the decades passed, caste obviously reared its ugly head back again because it never really went anywhere. And as a result, many Dalit people who, like my family, who had been able to break out of our caste-based professions, thanks to affirmative action, we felt that if we were to survive in the society, if we were to assimilate, if the society was to accept us, and in order to escape that, we felt there was no other way than to hide our caste identities, to change our last names, and to pass, which is a term, again, it could be interpreted in many different ways, but to pass as dominant caste people, which meant to drop our last names, to try and assimilate into dominant caste culture, and most importantly, having to lie about your caste identity. Because like I said, in India, caste is an ever-present reality, so it never really goes anywhere. At the same time, it's invisible. You cannot see your caste because it's not necessarily imprinted on the color of skin. So when I decided to write this book and I decided to think about my identity, I wanted to give us a sort of a unifier, a common language, which identifies Dalit people who have been hiding their identity. And the language that for me most effectively worked was coming out, because being a queer person myself, I thought of caste as a kind of a closet. I wasn't out with my queerness until it was only last year that I was forcefully outed. And people would be like, oh, do you think you've borrowed this term from the LGBTQ community? And I would often say people understand what it means to step out of that closet of shame that you have been forced into, because ultimately, at the end of the day, these are arbitrary distinctions. And I think of a closet of caste in a very similar way, where this is an arbitrary distinction that has been placed on us. And that's why I decided to talk about coming out as Dalit, where you own your identity with pride and remove or leave behind the shame that has been foisted upon you, in very similar ways to how people declare their sexuality, how I declared my sexuality and said I'm coming out as a bisexual person. The book came out in 2019. It opened to a really wonderful reception, the kind of which that I was not expecting. In essence, I wrote this book for myself. 15-year-old me would be able to read this book and say, you know, I know what to think. I know how to define my past. I know how to speak up. And I think that's why there has been such a tremendous resonance among Dalit people with this book, and it has done extremely well. It's been 5 years, and it is still recognized. It's still talked about. I'm really happy to say the book is already part of curriculum in many universities across the country, including what I know. I'm from Columbia, so I know it is being taught in Columbia. I know it's in Harvard and UC Davis, and several universities across the country have adapted the book into their curriculums. For me, this is the central thesis of the book. Caste is so invisibilized and erased in the Indian subcontinent, in South Asia in general. And if you just peel back two or three layers of what the culture is made of, you'll see that the bedrock is caste. Everything that's running in the country is running on the basis of caste. My mom, for example, when she wanted to start a food truck in India, in Rajasthan, where I'm from, people did not want to eat food cooked by a Dalit woman because our identity is that of being untouchable. So that was a commerce venture that a Dalit person could not undertake, but because they would run out of the market, because nobody would want to eat food cooked by a Dalit person. You go and find an apartment, your caste will be questioned. And now, more so, your religion will be questioned as well. You'll be found out if you're a Hindu or a Muslim person, what caste you belong to. If you go for a job application, inevitably, your last name will be screened. It's a part of housing, it's a part of employment, it's a part of business, it's a part of entertainment. Any industry that you look at in India is run on caste. Any interaction that you think about in India happening, if you are not from the culture, that might not seem evident to you, but you're from the culture, even, you know, and it becomes so normalized that you don't even think about that this is a caste-related interaction. So when I say caste is the bedrock of Indian community and Indian culture, that's absolutely valid, and that's what the book is about. Homophobia, in general, has been extremely prevalent within the entire Indian subcontinent and India in particular. What is agreed upon is when the British came to India, they banned homosexuality, they banned homosexual expression, and that became the norm for the culture. Until even 10 years ago, you could not say the word gay in a very common context. Now, of course, that has changed because of the recent efforts to bring homosexuality out in the open. And most importantly, there are so many prominent Dalit queer people who are making themselves known, who are getting their voices heard, who are becoming more and more visible. And they're claiming Dalit queer identities, which signal to other Dalit people who are queer and might be in the closet that it is safe for us to do so and that we can also have a voice, but also the rest of the Dalit community, that these people are powerful change makers and they should be given the same kind of respect as any other non-queer person. So I think attitudes are on the change, they're on the mend, and it reflects more or less on how the rest of the country operates as well. Dalit communities have been historically marginalized. They have not had access to education. So it's only in the last two or three generations that some Dalit people, but if you think of that demographic, a very small sliver, have been able to transcend their caste-based labor professions and get into middle class and upper middle class. When they own status symbols of wealth, they are attacked because the idea of a Dalit person owning a car is not synonymous with the idea of caste system. In fact, any kind of symbols of vanity the Dalit people have are attacked. Last week, a Dalit person was killed because he had a mustache and he had a turban, which are all symbols of status, wealth, and caste in India. And a Dalit person just having those symbols was deemed so unworthy that he was supposed to be punished by death. The way some foreign theorists and Western theorists have talked about caste is as division of labor. Dr. Ambedkar talks about caste as division of laborers. People who do that job, a particular kind of job, are divided into a certain caste. For example, Brahmins are known as the learned caste, as the intellectual caste, the people who are related with education, who are the priests. The Kshatriyas are the warrior castes, people who are kings, people who are soldiers, people who are generals. Then there is the Vaishyas, the business castes who are engaged in business, who are merchants, who are very, very prominent in Indian economy as people who are employed in various, engaged in various forms of business. And then, of course, there's the peasant or the Shudra castes, who are farmers, who are other backward castes. They're lower castes, but below them, called the untouchable castes, which are the Dalits. And they perform the dehumanizing labor that is not considered fit to be performed by anyone else in the society. Whether there is bedroom scavenging, which is the caste of my family, you know, cleaning human excrement, dealing with dead animals, burning dead bodies. And think of all the other devalued, dehumanized professions. That's what Dalits are supposed to do. That's what the caste profession is. And one of the tenets of caste system that is so significant is that there is no movement between castes. While you're alive in this life, and if you're born in a certain caste, there is no way for you to transcend it. But there is no way like a rich Dalit person doesn't become a Brahmin by getting a PhD. They will still remain Dalit. Thanks to affirmative action, very recently, maybe 70 years ago, a very small fraction of that population has been able to break out of the caste-based labor that we are forced to do. And I will tell you, even now, I have relatives who are immediate or extended family who are still engaged in that caste-based labor, who have not been able to break out of that cycle. And that is the reality for most people in India, who maybe they're not directly cleaning human excrement, but they are still associated with the general area of that job, because that's the kind of job only Dalit people can do. So that's how the caste system perpetuates and affects the job economy. And I will again say that with a caveat, things are changing very slowly, and there are exceptions to every rule, but the rule is caste defines what jobs you're able to get. Especially in the private sector, where if you're in an interview, they will directly ask you what your caste is. Because Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, right before his death, he led hundreds of thousands of Dalit people into mass conversions, into Buddhism, because he felt Buddhism was the way out of the Hindu religion, which is based on the division of its followers into separate castes. As a result, over years as Buddhism has evolved, it has come to be associated with Dalit people who converted into Buddhism, thanks to Ambedkar. Now, especially, you know, in the US, where caste is so coded, if somebody says, oh, do you celebrate so-and-so Hindu religious festival? And the answer is, oh, I don't, because I'm a Buddhist. That's all they need to say. Their caste is out. They might have been trying to protect their caste. They might have been trying to pass as a dominant caste person. But if they reveal their religion, that secret is out. And then they will be treated as a Dalit person is treated. So religion is a big marker. I think we are all aware at this point in India, Muslims are being treated with a very heightened kind of discrimination, whether it's in workplaces in India or even with some heavily Indian diaspora populated workplaces in the United States. If someone's an Indian Muslim, they'd be told that they're from Pakistan, they're not Indian. Over the years, especially as the violence against Muslim people, Muslims in India, has become so much more visible and has increased, there has been a natural alliance that forms between Dalits and Muslims. But I would like to underscore that even within the Muslim community, caste system exists. And it's because caste is a part of the Indian subcontinent. And while it is not a part of the Muslim scripture, it is a part of the culture. And it is a part of the Pakistan community as well. Pakistani communities in the United States and back in the South Asian subcontinent also have castes. They also have versions of castes that are practiced, which might look different from how they look elsewhere, but caste is practiced everywhere. Caste is practiced in Sri Lanka. Caste is practiced in Nepal. Caste is practiced in India. I come from the state in India, which is Rajasthan, one of the most feudal, one of the most conservative states in the country. And giving birth to two daughters is the deadliest of sins that a woman can commit. I remember when my sister was born, a couple of months after, there was another lady who was pregnant in the house. And I think somebody from her in-laws, my grandparents, said, oh, don't go in front of her. She is cursed because she only gives birth to daughters. And that's just like an instance of emotional and verbal abuse. But physical abuse is littered in her life. And that is the position of Dalit women who are in families who have somehow escaped the caste-based labor. Now think about the families where women are still engaged in the dehumanizing jobs that they're forced into. First of all, their labor is not valued. They are not given the same amount of money that a Dalit man will for maybe even the same kind of work. And often they are given not money, but goods. They will be given stale food. They will be given old clothes. So they're dehumanized on many levels. And, you know, speaking of sexual assault and abuse, Dalit women are considered property. In fact, in all of the country, if a landlord has a Dalit man working on his land as indentured or bonded labor, and he gets married, he has, and it's still practiced, maybe it's not talked about, but in the hinterlands, rural parts of the country, he has access to rape her anytime he wants. And that's just accepted. Over the years, the representation of Dalit people has been, in Indian cinema, either it was, let's see and uncover the trauma that Dalit people face, and let's just see how awful their lives are, and just give them that one particular dimension, that suffering is the only measure of their life. Now, that has changed dramatically in the past 7 to 8 years. And that's happened because of Dalit people. That's happened because of Dalit writers, Dalit activists, Dalit entertainers, talking about how we need to have equal space. But I also want to highlight that with the additional visibility of Dalit people, also are coming challenges of our lives and our creative talent being exploited. It was exactly a year ago in August, from friends, they saying that there is a show based on your life. And I said, that can't be true, because that's a show. I know that somebody gets married in the end, and they explore the marriage aspect, and I'm not married. So they said, but you have to look at it. And I saw, and it was me, but one of my interviews, the same style and all of that. And when I asked for credit, just credit, no compensation, just an acknowledgement. First of all, they gave me an Instagram post where they said, oh, it's from here and there and everywhere else. It's not just her. But I said, I'm not okay with this. This is my life story. It's taken me years of not just therapy, but also courage and conviction to be able to sit in front of an audience and accept that shameful secret that I held so close to my chest, which is that I come from a manual scavenging caste family and I have been passing as a dominant caste person. You can't just take that story from me, because that's all I have, and make a movie out of it. And that created such an enormous backlash. And I was met with one of the most brutal hate campaigns that people have seen in Indian. And I was dragged on for days in Indian social media by prominent Bollywood directors who called me an opportunist, who called me a narcissist, who said I didn't care about Dalit people because I was saying this was my story. I should just be quiet and let my life's work be exploited and taken away from me without even a single credit. But it still belongs to me. This is my life story. And the backlash I was hit with lasted, you would believe it or not, until January 2024. And if somebody in my position can face that harassment, then you think about Dalit women who don't have a voice and how it affects them. So I want to make this point that there is a great deal of tremendous positive representation that we are experiencing. But also with representation comes the chance of our voices being exploited. So that has to go hand in hand. Every time I speak, I want to speak about Rohit Vemmala. The reason I'm speaking to here today is Rohit Vemmala and his passing, and the book exists because of him. Rohit Vemmala, for those of us who might not be aware, was a Dalit PhD student in the University of Hyderabad in India, who was not hiding his caste like me, who came from a low-income background, whose mother had worked in other people's homes and stitched people's clothes and had worked in construction, hard labor jobs to be able to send her children to school. And he was calling out the institutional discrimination that he was facing at the university, which is very intense. And in this year, in 2024, we have just come from, you know, seeing the encampments across universities in the country. And we know how universities can hit back at students that they don't like. And that's what was happening to him. Ultimately, it became too much, because when you don't have a support system, when you don't come from an influential family, you don't have money. Life can be so difficult when a whole institution is lashing out at you. He ended up taking his own life. And what he left behind was a letter that is, and I've never stopped saying this, one of the most significant texts written by a Dalit person in English, because it's changed the way how an entire nation thought about caste and how an entire nation looked at Dalit people. It humanized Dalits in a way that had never been done before. And most importantly, more than how others think of us, it changed how Dalits think about ourselves. I remember it was 2016, really cold afternoon in New York City, and I was already living here. And I read it once on my computer and read it twice, and it struck me that this could have been my life, that this could have been me with just a few differences. And I realized I had to do something with all this knowledge and experience I had. And that's when I decided to create a safe space for Dalit people to just talk about our caste, to talk about our trauma, maybe create a space where Rohit Vemmala could have been a part of and talked about how horrible it was for him, maybe gotten some help. And that was the plan that I had at that time. I decided that I couldn't ask people to justifiably talk about their own stories when I was still hiding my caste. Who am I otherwise? And so it was through him, inspired by him, that I decided to write a note saying, today I'm coming out as Dalit. And his writing, his voice, his words that are filled with so much despair and sadness, but also so much hope and potential at the same time, it made me reveal the secret that I had held so close to my heart for so many years. And I told everybody my true caste identity. And I said, I am stepping out of the shame and I'm stepping into the pride that I know our people deserve and we have never received. In the past couple of years, we have seen a lot of conversations around caste in the United States as it pertains to Dalit communities. Cisco case is one of the most landmark and significant cases of caste, where a Dalit engineer took his Brahmin managers to court and the Cisco company because he was being systemically discriminated for his caste for several years. It was found out that he accessed affirmative action and therefore he was Dalit. And then a series of discriminations began. His projects weren't getting approved. You know, he was not getting the promotions that he was promised. He was not getting salary hikes. And it went on for a very long time. And then he took it to the HR at Cisco Systems. And the HR said, caste is not a protected category. And therefore, we have no obligation to protect you. I don't agree with caste not being a protected category in California, which is where Silicon Valley is, which is where a bulk of the tech working Indian immigrant population is, which is where people need protections. One of the things that I would like to talk about is caste as race as a category. And I think that's really important to discuss. And I would like to say that we have so much solidarity, especially with oppressed people in here in the United States, especially Black folks, because a lot of Dalit theory, a lot of my ideas are very inspired by what Black women have experienced and laid down and talked about how to break through from these systems. They're definitely trailblazers and path breakers in showing me personally, and I'm only going to speak for myself, but also a lot of Dalit women have talked about how they lead us. America has been talking about race a lot longer than we have been consistently talking about caste. But at the same time, it seems to be a tendency to equate caste and race. That is not something that's going to serve anybody. Because caste, as I repeatedly said in this conversation, is an invisible system of discrimination. You know, you don't necessarily pick it out by the color of someone's skin, and it is not so apparent. And if we say one is equal to the other, then we'll do a disservice to both, because Black folks have a much longer history in this country of being enslaved and being brought here against their will, and then having built this country in so many significant ways, and then being kept out of the profits. So it's been a long history that they share, and we have a different history of coming from India. So I think it's important to understand both systems independently on their own with synergies and parallels, but not something that can overlap just for the sake of convenience. I think it's important for us to hold the nuance that exists in both.
This is part 7 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or do they?
Good morning. I would not be around when you read this letter. Don't get angry on me. I know some of you truly cared for me, loved me, and treated me very well. I have no complaints on anyone. It was always with myself I had problems. I feel a growing gap between my soul and my body, and I have become a monster. I always wanted to be a writer. A writer of science like Carl Sagan. At last, this is the only letter I'm going to write. I loved science, stars, nature, but then I loved people without knowing that people have long since divorced from nature. Our feelings are second-handed, our love is constructed, our beliefs colored, our originality valid through artificial art. It has become truly difficult to love without getting hurt. The value of a man was reduced to his immediate identity and nearest possibility, to a vote, to a number, to a thing. Never was a man treated as mind, as a glorious thing made up of stardust, in very field, in studies, in streets, in politics, and in dying and living. I'm writing this kind of letter for the first time, my first time of a final letter. Forgive me if I fail to make sense. Maybe I was wrong all the while in understanding world, in understanding love, pain, life, death. There was no urgency, but I was always rushing, desperate to start a life. All the while, some people, for them, life itself is curse. My birth is my fatal accident. I can never recover from my childhood loneliness, the unappreciated child from my past. I'm not hurt at this moment. I'm not sad. I'm just empty, unconcerned about myself. That's pathetic, and that's why I'm doing this. People may dub me as a coward and selfish or stupid once I'm gone. I'm not bothered about what I'm called. I don't believe in after-death stories, ghosts, or spirits. If there is anything at all I believe that I can travel to the stars and know about the other worlds. If you, who is reading this letter, can do anything for me, I have to get 7 months of my fellowship, 1,75,000 rupees. Please see to it that my family is paid that. I have to give some 40,000 to Ramji. He never asked them back, but please pay that to him from that. Let my funeral be silent and smooth. Behave like I just appeared and gone. Do not shed tears for me. Know that I'm happy dead than being alive. From shadows to stars. Uma Anna, sorry for using your room for this thing. To ASA family, sorry for disappointing all of you. You loved me very much. I wish all the very best for the future. For one last time, Jai Bhim. I forgot to write the formalities. No one is responsible for my act. No one is responsible for this act of killing myself. No one has instigated me, whether by their acts or by their words, to this act. This is my decision, and I am the only one responsible for this. Do not trouble my friends and enemies on this after I am gone.
My name is S. Shankar. I am professor of English at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I would describe myself as a novelist and a literary critic. My last novel, Ghost in the Tamarind, is a historical novel set in South India against the background of anti-caste movements. Caste is both easy to define and difficult to define. Everybody sort of thinks they know what it is. It is hereditary, social location,